This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This podcast is sponsored by Cloud Optimizer.
As a business owner or IT manager, are your cloud investment costs going up and you don't know why? It's time for Cloud Optimizer. As you migrate your business to the cloud, what you're spending and why you're spending it can get a little hazy. But Cloud Optimizer clears up the mystery and puts the cloud to work for you. Cloud Optimizer starts by analyzing usage patterns, right-sizing resources, leveraging discounts you may not be aware of, implementing automation, and much more. And by reducing unnecessary expenses and maximizing performance, Cloud Optimizer guarantees you a savings of 5 times what you spend for their service. As you utilize cloud-based services more and more, you don't have to lose sight or control of your spend. You can stay agile, streamline your costs, and optimize your performance, plus save significant money with Cloud Optimizer.
Make the cloud work for you with Cloud Optimizer. Get a free assessment and find out how much you can save by going to cloudoptimizer.com. Go to cloudoptimizer.com for your free assessment. That's cloudoptimizer.com.
Ladies and gentlemen,
can I please have your attention?
Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by the Dispatch and Dispatch Media. I'm recording this extra early this morning, and I'm going to have to do it fast because we have a huge chunk of our staff in this week for the Dispatch, and we are doing media training seminar, which hopefully Sarah is going to take the lead on because she's been a media trainer, and I had to take media training once. This is not an interesting topic. I'll be quick. I was a television producer. I knew a little bit about TV. I've watched a lot of TV, and I've been on a lot of TV, and so I'm not saying media training is pointless, but particularly for people in my line of work and the kinds of people that we hire and the kinds of people I've worked with, like at National Review and AEI and et cetera, a big chunk of media training is explaining to people how to relax and not take it too seriously rather than building them up for, like, you know, this is like tightrope walking and you could die. Doesn't mean there aren't like little tricks and little things to know. And when you're starting out, you don't know that it's really just not that hard or impressive or anything like that. But then there are also, I don't want to second guess people. There's some people who have real sort of shyness issues, you know, all that kind of thing. One of the things that was always amazing to me when I was a television producer was how, and this comes up a little bit with podcasts. Like if there's somebody I've never heard speak and really have, don't know much about them, I'll ask Guy to go and look for a podcast he's been on or look for a YouTube channel that he's been on or she's been on, they've been on, just to make sure that they can talk. And because, I mean, there's a difference between podcast talking, obviously, and TV talking. But there are some people who are legit bad at both. And then there are some weirdly who are only bad at one of them. Like when I was a TV producer, we would run into this every, like, and again, the TV show I mainly produced was this TV show called Think Tank with Ben Wattenberg, and it was pretty dorky. Sort of deep dives on a single public policy issue every episode kind of thing with various experts. And but we would have, you know, like Nat Glaser, who I'd been reading for a long time, I think is one of the great sort of neocon public intellectuals, for those of a certain generation out there. I'm not going to get deep in the weeds on this, but like when I say he's a great neocon public intellectual, it literally has nothing to do with foreign policy. It almost has nothing to do with like being a Republican, because he was mostly kind of a social Democrat kind of guy. But he was a beautiful writer, really smart. And you read him and he was one of those writers where your eyes just move through the text sometimes as if there's no resistance, because he was just such a clear writer. And then you put him on TV and he was like Larry David's much more Jewish uncle who had really bad hay fever. And he would like blow his nose on TV, which again, we're doing media training today. I will tell people, don't blow your nose on TV. Another one, we didn't have him on the show, but we did interviews with him, was what's his name? Richard Posner, who's a big, appellate court judge, one of the foremost sort of legal public intellectual guys. He's been on something of a journey, in retirement or semi-retirement or whatever, but was sort of a law and economics guy, really smart, wrote a bunch of books, really clear, forceful, declarative writer. And then you get him on TV and he looks at his shoes for the entire interview. So there are some people who are sort of outliers, but in general, it's just not that. Getting out of your head when you do TV is the biggest trick of doing TV. It's just not rocket science. Anyway, moving on. So this leaker thing, I want to say I kind of called it. I directionally called it on the Dispatch podcast this week. I had said this whole thing is kind of sketch, and I should probably have gone back and look what my exact quote was, but it kind of felt like the kid of somebody with security clearance showing off to his friends and that kind of thing. It wasn't quite that, obviously, but sort of the same dynamic. This is a 21-year-old guy hanging out with a bunch of gamers on Discord. He did it, you know, again, like we are in now the gladiatorial phase of spin control on all of this about what his motives are or were. You know, one of the kids from this gamer group gave one of those super pixelated hidden identity interviews. He was saying there was no political agenda to this whatsoever. He was not trying to help Russia or hurt Ukraine or undermine the Biden administration. And that's going to be inconvenient. It's clearly inconvenient to one group, and it's probably going to be inconvenient to two groups. The first group that it's already inconvenient for is like the Marjorie Taylor Greene caucus, the Tucker Carlson caucus, who have behaved grotesquely in the last 24 hours, indefensibly. I expect moronic statements from Marjorie Taylor Greene. I have I am not a big fan of Tucker's shtick now, and I think so much of it really is shtick, even if it's shtick to entertain himself and he doesn't really realize what a mess he's become intellectually and politically. But Tucker's still just orders of magnitude smarter than Marjorie Taylor Greene. But I caught some of his monologue last night, and I don't watch Tucker's show, but my wife and I were actually watching Perry Mason. And since that was on demand, yes, I still get cable. When the show ended, it ended like right before or right in the middle or at the start of Tucker's monologue. So the audio just started playing, and I was like, oh, what fresh hell is this? Anyway, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Tucker, they want this kid to be the leaker, to be a whistleblower, truth teller, hero, martyr. In case you missed it, this is, I'm not gonna read this whole friggin' thing, but this is what Marjorie Taylor Greene released last night on Twitter. Yeah, so this is what she tweeted last night, which I think was the dumbest statement of the day, or late yesterday afternoon. She says, Jake Teixeira, who's the leaker, is white, male, Christian, and anti-war. That makes him an enemy of the Biden regime. And he told the truth about troops being on the ground in Ukraine and a lot more. Ask yourself, who is the real enemy? A young, low-level National Guardsman or the administration that is waging war in Ukraine, a non-NATO nation against nuclear Russia without war powers? Now, first of all, like, who's the real enemy? Like, the guy who leaked classified, I mean, he's not an enemy. He's a criminal. All this enemy talk is like so promiscuous and ridiculous. This Teixeira guy, and I feel so bad for Roy Teixeira, my colleague at AEI, because I think Teixeira is actually a pretty common Portuguese name, but not in the States. And I wonder how many people are wondering if he's asking him if he's related. Anyway, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on Marjorie Taylor Greene because Marjorie Taylor Greene is profoundly stupid. She's basically the Korean toilet ghost of American politics. And shame on the right for signal boosting this chick all the time. But just to be clear, like, leading with the fact that he's a white male Christian, like, how do you think people are going to read that? I mean, if the leaker were, you know, a black female Muslim or a Jew or something, like, would she think that therefore their crimes need a closer look and be less likely to support them as a quote unquote whistleblower? But more broadly, the guy's not a whistleblower, right? I mean, at least according to that interview, at least according to the Washington Post stuff, he's not a whistleblower. He's a dork with self-esteem issues. One of these sort of, you know, insul or insul adjacent. I mean, again, we may find out new things. So, you know, this is just from what we know, which at least I'm trying to stick close to. He did this to show off, not to like be a major player in a major national security issue or to choose sides in a geostrategic struggle or to bring down a government or to be, you know, a whistleblower or anything like that. He was showing off to his bro friends. And that spin is not very, that interpretation of things is not very useful to Tucker. Tucker, who last night just lied. He lies now. You know, I'm sure he's somewhat lawyered down in some way about some of this stuff. But like, you know, by the way he talks, the impression that he wants his audience to have, to take from his statements, Tucker's just a flat out liar now. And it's sad. And it's really pathetic, given that he always talks about how the show is the enemy of spin and is the bastion of truth and all that kind of stuff. And then he sits there this week and just lets Trump lie to his face and does nothing about it. I mean, it's just propagandizing. So Fox News, the news side of Fox, reported that the American forces that are in Ukraine aren't fighting Russian forces. That's what Tucker said last night, is that American troops are fighting Russian troops in a war. And at least the news division of Tucker's own network says that's not true, that these guys were basically there as part of like the oversight to make sure that our money was being well spent and like, and was working with embassy stuff for security and that kind of thing. But Tucker wants to say that this is a war, that it's an outrageous war. He wants to say that this is like the Pentagon Papers and that everybody who doesn't love this guy is a hypocrite because the people who love Chelsea Manning and all those people are not rallying to Teixeira's defense. And he's got a point, not much of one, but he's got a point insofar as the people who rallied to Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, they were wrong too. But Tucker wants to be the wrong in the same way that the people he's criticizing were wrong about Teixeira, right? Rather, the thing to do is be consistent and say the people who violate the national security of the United States and disclose vital sensitive information that could get people killed are doing the wrong thing, regardless of their political motivations. This is such a problem with the right these days, that some people on the right want to use the gateway drug is this hypocrisy stuff, right? They hold up the left's own standards and then say, see how you're falling short of those standards. And that's fine. I believe in that kind of argumentation. I think that's actually part of persuasion. That's why I wrote Suicide the West the way I wrote it, is I was trying to say that, you know, these things are good by the left's own understanding of what's good. But what Tucker and Green and all these, you know, jabbering, you know, bandersnatches say is they end up doing is they end up internalizing the left's standards and the left's categories for their own tribe, turning this guy who's just at minimum, a moron criminal, going by the facts that we have right now, who's done serious damage to the United States government, to our allies, and to the people we're helping win or fight a war in Ukraine. Also, he could seem like the coolest dude in a Discord chat room. And these guys are turning him into a prop. They're turning him into some sort of, you know, horse vessel, Matthew Shepard kind of symbolic figure. In the same way they used that kid who shot a couple people. I can't remember his name. And I'm sure there are people who are horrified that I cannot remember the name of this dashboard saint martyr who went running into who drove for, you know, hours so that he could bring a gun to George Floyd riots type stuff and shoot somebody. I'm not saying the guy was guilty of homicide, you know, first degree murder or anything like that, but like he was being an idiot and he was putting himself in a situation where he had no reasonable expectation to do any good and where lots of bad things could happen. But he's become whatever the guy's name is. I can't remember. This, you know, grand martyr to, you know, the coming civil war against the forces of wokeness kind of thing. Anyway, the other group, I'm glad I remembered, the other group that is really going to hate the facts of why this kid did what he did, if they don't change, are his lawyers. Because as stupid as it is, as an excuse, saying you're a whistleblower, saying you're doing journalism, saying you're holding the government accountable, all of that sort of allegedly high-minded stuff, which I still think does not matter. Snowden should be in jail. Chelsea Manning should still be in jail. This guy should go to jail if in fact he's as guilty of what he's accused of. But those sort of motivations win you converts and friends and supporters and could work on juries, saying that, you know, this was your way of showing off to a bunch of teenagers does not win you like huge numbers of supporters from anywhere. And so it will not shock me at all if the lawyers, you know, particularly after, you know, Tucker offers a really sympathetic interview with whoever he can, tell him to shut up and get ready to spin out this narrative like he was helping America and trying to stop World War III and yada, yada, yada. Because that's just I don't think there's any defense, but PR and legally wise, it's a better defense than what seems to be the truth, which is that, you know, he was showing how cool he was to a bunch of kids who like to meme allegedly racist and anti-Semitic stuff. And that's the other thing is like, if you listen to the Tucker monologue, he thinks that the fact that the kid was being accused by the media of being racist is somehow proof that he's a hero. Like that there are no legitimate accusations of racism or legitimate accusations of anti-Semitism that can be aimed at, you know, young right-wing males. Like that's just an illegitimate thing to say. And it can be an illegitimate thing to say, for sure. The charge of racism gets thrown around a lot. Gets thrown around a lot in cases where it's outrageous and indefensible. But you know who are racists? Racists. You know who are anti-Semites? Anti-Semites. And calling a racist or an anti-Semite anti-Semitic, when they are in fact racist or anti-Semitic, is not illegitimate. And yet that's the sort of cultural weird dog whistle signaling that you see in so much of this stuff. It's like, you know, they're coming for your freedom to be a racist kind of thing. And I think you have freedom to be racist, by the way, but we also have freedom to criticize and shame racism. And if these kids are sitting around, you know, yelling stupid anti-Semitic and racist stuff, I'm not sure how incredibly relevant it is in a criminal sense. And I do think there is some sort of like work from the mainstream media to sort of prepare people to hate this guy for those reasons so that you don't have to think he's some sort of free speech martyr and all that kind of stuff. But if the accusation's true, like, it doesn't speak well of him. And that's the problem with this sort of binary thing is if one side doesn't like you, that means you're good, which is just the most asinine, exhausting way of going through life. Not all of your enemies' enemies are your friends, particularly if you are not engaged in some sort of Machiavellian 15th century Florence Game of Thrones kind of, you know, scheming battle for ultimate supremacy. And not if you're fighting World War II, fine. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. But like in real life, the enemy of your enemy can also be a dick. And like this idea that like somehow this is what Popular Front ism, this is what, you know, this I've been consistent about this for 30 years. You can go back and find stuff I wrote in, like, I don't know, 1999 about why I don't like the Popular Front. Popular Front was originally a concept of the left, right? It was like all the parties of the left need to unite and not criticize each other. The phrase in French, you know, ribbit, 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 les gauche. It's like no enemies to the left, right? And it was a great strategy by communists to get credentials and legitimacy from more mainstream parties. And it seemed like a worthwhile, pragmatic approach by more mainstream liberal parties because of the common enemy of fascist parties and that kind of thing. And of course, as happened again and again and again in all sorts of places, communists were very happy to use Popular Front tactics when they were in their interest. But then once they got any kind of power, they were perfectly happy to throw everybody under the bus on the left and the right who wasn't abjectly loyal to the Communist Party. Be fun to do an actual whole podcast just on sort of the history of communist tactics in a democracy. Yes, but Popular Frontism says I have to completely shut up about my disagreements with my own side because I hate the other side so much. And I got 7 years of Popular Front BS since Trump came down the friggin' escalator. People telling me that because the Democrats are so much worse, you shouldn't care that Trump is lying, corrupt, you know, all these kinds of things. You shouldn't care that he's a protectionist. You shouldn't care that he's openly hostile to the First Amendment or openly hostile to the Constitution, or that he's crude or boorish. All that mattered was that, you know, we stay unified in this cult of personality around this guy because the left is such a greater danger. And that's just not the conservatism I grew up with. Conservatism I grew up with is we had all sorts of internal debates and disagreements. And I think that made us stronger. It let people understand that their coalitional, sparring partners, were people of good faith, that their motives were sound. And instead, when you have Popular Frontism, everybody sort of, is constantly on the hunt for traitors and on the hunt for people who are less pure than we are and that kind of thing. And I just think it's just nonsense.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
There's one last point I wanted to make about this leak. What's really, and maybe I'll write about this, but like, what's really grotesque about it is that, you know, I know there are a lot of people who've just kind of tuned out the war in Ukraine, but I pay pretty close attention to it. It's one of the few news stories that I try to stay up on daily. In a more than just sort of, oh, what's the latest development kind of thing. And what the Russians are doing in Ukraine is evil. And I talked about this with Fred Kagan in really, I think, one of the best podcasts I've done in a couple of years. Not because of me, but because of Fred. It was just a really great conversation. Lots of people liked it. You should check it out. And I wrote my LA Times column a little bit about this, is that, you know, the Russian military has been objectively, as the Marxists might like to say, has been objectively cruel and barbaric for over a century. And I'll talk more about that in a second, but let me just get this last point about the leaker out. And the things that they're doing in Ukraine are so evil. The greater evil is against what they're doing to Ukrainians, but it's also worth noting that the evil they're doing to Russians is horrendous as well. I mean, you literally have officers referring to some troops as disposables, right? Let's like throw 5 disposables at that machine gun nest so we can figure out what their position is, that kind of thing. The Russian army is raping and torturing people. There are reports, there are credible reports about 4-year-old girl being sexually abused. I'm not going to get graphic on it, but and at least according to the report, one of the officers who forced himself on this little kid, I mean, little babe, barely out of being objectively a baby, joked about how, well, now I'll turn her into a woman. Old ladies are getting raped. There are mass graves with scores of people with their hands tied behind their back. You know, people are getting mutilated, tortured. And that just leaves out, like, you know, the more, you know, banal evils, as Hannah Arendt might say, of schools being targeted with missiles, playgrounds being blown up, apartment complexes being, bombed, with the intent, the explicit intent of killing civilians and terrorizing the population. And, you know, just for all you people who keep saying, oh, well, this is just a normal conflict, it's a border dispute, you know, which I'm glad Ron DeSantis walked away from that phrase. It's not a friggin' border dispute. You had Dmitry Medvedev on Friday, former president of Russia, and he's now like the number 2 guy in the State Security Council, talking about how Ukraine will simply disappear. It will stop being, and this is what, you know, Fred and I were talking about a bit, it will stop being a country. If Putin takes Kiev and takes control of the country, there will be massive genocide. And I don't just mean the cultural genocide that the Russians have been trying to do for a while there. I mean, straight up, ethnic cleansing, mass slaughter. And so you imagine, like, you're a Ukrainian who's been, sleeping in either frozen or muddy ditches for a year, and you're working with, and you're hearing how the Americans are behind you and all this kind of stuff. And this kid thinks that effort is so trivial that, and he takes his job so cavalierly that he's like, yeah, what's the harm of me, showing off to my buddies this stuff that I have access to, because it makes me seem cool. It's just like sort of the gross self-indulgence of it. And then to call that act, heroic whistleblowing and speaking truth to power, it's all so craven and cynical and gross. And, you know, this crowd that just will not, like, there is a intellectually defensible realist case for letting horrible people do horrible things to other people. It is not our job to prevent every dictator from doing a bad thing everywhere. I don't think we are the world's policemen. But the least you can do is bear witness, right? The least is you can tell truth about what is happening. The least you can do is when you see institutionalized rape and slaughter in a grotesque criminal invasion of another country, the least is you can just call it that and not mock the people who take it seriously and not mock the victims by saying, this is no big deal. This happens all the time. And I'm just so disgusted by the number of people that I know used to agree with that point, who now, because they think it's more important to like own the libs or something, than to just simply tell the truth about what evil people are doing. It's really just depressing. Anyway, the communism thing, or the Russian army thing. So I've been reading a little bit about this. I really want to do more. Part of it is that my wife, as you guys know, the fair Jessica, is working on this biography of her dad. And she's gotten, I would maybe argue, a little too into the weeds on some of the Eastern Europe stuff, but she's really interested in it. And she's doing this as a labor of love. I just keep telling her, you know, at some point he has to get to Alaska and you got to start, doing research about that. She had a degree from Johns Hopkins in Soviet politics, and she was raised by at least equally anti-communist dad as I was. And so she's really interested in it. And we're talking about it, and I'm looking at some of her books and stuff. And it's interesting, the thing that, so there are a couple things. One is, I remember when the POW MIA stuff really kind of like became a prairie fire politically and culturally in the United States. I remember asking my dad whether he thought, the North Vietnamese or the Vietnamese, because they stopped being the North Vietnamese after they won, whether they really did have Americans still as POWs. And his position was, well, obviously we can't be 100% sure, but it's definitely possible. And then he gave me this long lecture about how communists has a policy forever, this thing about taking, not just POWs, but whole populations as hostages, and putting them in internal exile in places where they're manageable and eventually destroyable, or barterable, right? Admittedly, the POW policy and the captive population policy are kind of different policies, but they come from the same moral framework, and there's just a really long history of them in all of these Marxist-Leninist regimes, chiefly, of course, pride of position goes to the Soviet Union. And then you see these stories about, taking kids away. The Soviets did that kind of thing in lots of places. I'm pretty sure they did it in the Greek Civil War. I'm sure, they did it in all sorts of internal, conflicts. Russification is a concept that goes back to the czars. And then the other thing is, I was reading all of these human rights reports about the rape stuff, and which is not cheery. And there's this great piece. There's a great piece in Commentary called "Do the Russians Worship War," which you should check out. We'll put it in the show notes. It's the current, I think it's still the current cover story of Commentary magazine. There is this stat in there about all the raping that the Red Army did when it quote unquote liberated Eastern Europe. And there was just this quote, I put it in my column. this just horrifying quote where, like, the health minister of Hungary basically asked his superiors in the government to declare, like, all babies born from, like, call it 19, from the fall of 46 to the spring of 48, something like that, that they should all be just simply declared orphans because it was just getting too difficult to claim otherwise. And people needed cover for the fact that they had been gotten pregnant through rape. And I started going down this rabbit hole, and Jessica was telling me about the stuff she knows about Prague. And it's really kind of amazing. And I kind of missed some of this stuff because this storyline comes out in after the fall of the Soviet Union. This is not part of a lot of, I mean, obviously there are stories of barbaric behavior and all that kind of stuff, but the systemic nature of the Red Army's rape and Stalin's tolerance for it really didn't come into focus until after the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall, when archives were opened. And it turns out that, like, the Red Army, you know, you can't say the entire Red Army, because the entire Red Army had like 12 million people in it. But the Red Army in Eastern Europe had at minimum a de facto policy that just raping the population was okay. And the estimates in some of the books, and I was reading in this book called Stalin's War, Stalin's Wars. Stalin's War is a different book, really interesting book. We can talk about that another time. And I was looking through some of Jess's books and stuff, and also, like, you know, the crimes against humanity or war crimes of the Red Army in East European countries, basically each country that was quote unquote liberated, as far as I can tell, has its own Wikipedia page just on these atrocities, just on the rapes in effect, plus mass shootings and torture and that kind of stuff. But the numbers for Hungary were somewhere, the low-end estimate was 10% of the female population, and as high as 40% of the female population was raped by the Red Army. In Germany, I don't remember what the percentages are, but the estimates are north of 1 million and almost 2 million women raped in just the parts of Germany that were controlled by Soviet forces. In Vienna, I think the stat I had in my column was between 70, Vienna alone, just the city of Vienna, like between 70 and 100,000 rapes. And then you get into all the other just horrendous things that the Red Army has done or been complicit in. You know, the mass deportation of POWs that Stalin didn't trust to bring home, so they were just essentially liquidated. You know, I read Victims of Malta while I was in high school, and it kind of shattered me in some ways. Did I say Malta? Yalta. The point here is not that, you know, I'm sure Tucker or somebody would say, well, look, bad things happen in war. War is bad. That's why we shouldn't go to war. And, you know, and superficially, that's absolutely right. We shouldn't go to war. You know, I'm much less rah-rah about war stuff than I was when I was younger. And it's absolutely true. Bad things happen in all wars. But that doesn't necessarily mean that all armies and all wars are equal. And I mean, you know, my friend David French, he was a lawyer serving as a lawyer, you know, at the front lines in a war. We send lawyers out to make sure that we adhere to our own laws, to the Geneva Conventions, all of these kinds of things, that we do things lawfully. Now, totally open that maybe we take that stuff too far, totally legit. Totally legit to argue that we don't take it far enough. The whole reason we have lawyers out there is because we think this is something that is worth debating, right? But we try real hard to learn lessons from the mistakes that we've made and not be, and not codify and own our most evil behaviors and impulses. The Red Army has never gone through that kind of introspection. The Red Army, you know, has never said, what can we learn about our behavior during World War II to become better? right? As Fred was pointing out, you know, it's like the Red Army has internalized this cultural notion that brutality is proof of determination to win. And therefore, the more brutal you are, the more committed to winning you are. And the things the Red Army is doing, you know, the things the Red Army has done, or actually, the things the Red Army did, it's not the Red Army anymore, it's the Russian Army. But, you know, part of my point is this remarkable continuity between them. Because, you know, look, I think talk about structural racism and, you know, structural sexism and all that kind of stuff is complicated but overblown. But if you have an institution that has literally been turned into the object of essentially a state religion, and where its most brutal behavior is codified as its most glorious behavior, odds are you're not going to have a lot of restraint when it comes to doing evil things. And, you know, you had Putin basically legalize war crimes. He basically said that, you know, they basically passed a law saying that no one in the Red Army in occupied Ukraine can be charged with violating a bunch of specific international or, you know, or domestic war crime laws. Like, basically, no one's going to get prosecuted. They also, you know, passed some sort of bill thing saying that the people who ordered these things cannot be prosecuted. They pulled themselves out of one of the codicils of the Geneva Convention to that end. And I think that just the way we talk about the war in Ukraine is like, I mean, you know, the Marjorie Taylor Greene crowd talks about it as if, you know, Putin's cool and impressive and kind of better than us because he's so willful and strong like bull. But even sort of among normal people who are probably rooting for Ukraine, there is still this underlying assumption that Russia's a normal country that got itself into a mistake. And I think the more you look at what Russia has become, and the way Putin is running it, it's this truly sinister and malevolent force. Now, the Russian people aren't necessarily that. I think there are a lot of Russian. I listened to this Economist podcast that just talks to sort of Russian, essentially, dissidents who are incredible. It's a very depressing podcast because it's just talking to one Russian or another who used to be proud of their country and is now in exile or otherwise, resisting and lamenting what Russia has become. And, so I'm not saying, you know, and there's I remember talking to Leon Aaron about this, you know, there is a tradition of real Western style liberalism, human rights, all that kind of thing in Russia. It's just never been able to reach critical mass institutionally, you know. If you watch what they say on that state TV stuff, and you got to remember, in state TV, everything that is said on those propaganda shows is said with the explicit approval of the state. Maybe not prior to it being said, because I do think some of those guys freelance. Like, there was that one guy who actually got pulled off air for saying that any child, like literally child, some sci-fi writer was talking about how when he was a kid, he had been in Ukraine and met kids who talked about how Ukraine was its own country. And the host of the show says, well, you know what you do with a kid like that is you drown him in the river right then and there. All those kids should be drowned, or they should be rounded up and put in churches or their houses and then set fire to the houses with their families inside. At least that guy was pulled off the air. So there's somebody somewhere who, like, says we got to be a little careful about what we say. But for the most part, the people who say on TV we should nuke Ukraine, we should, you know, commit mass slaughter and all that kind of stuff, they're allowed to say it. Whereas the people who say this war is a mistake, they're not allowed to say anything. And so, you know, at the level of sort of national character formation, the Russian government is basically just freaking evil now. And this desire to reduce everything to the sort of realist calculation of moral equivalence between, you know, state actors acting on their interests, I just find repugnant and ridiculous. Again, doesn't require us to, you know, strap on boots and send American troops into the mix, but it does require, I think, morally, at least speaking honestly about what's going on.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Debated is the wrong word, had a spirited discussion with Sarah Isger on the first podcast of the week. It's funny, Sarah, at the end of it, I don't think we were saying it on air, but she was saying how she was sure that listeners were going to take my side in it. And I was like, nah, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure that they're going to think you won this thing. And she was like, no. And I was right. Most listeners took her side. And I get why you take your side. I get it. I don't think I did a particularly fantastic job articulating my position. I tried much harder in the Wednesday G file to sort of explain where I was coming from and admit that, you know, my views have changed closer to Sarah's than I had kind of realized when I gotten into this whole Skokie debate thing. But I don't think the fact that all the listeners agree with Sarah and that I'm essentially agree with Sarah is a good thing. I think it is a sign of how degraded our culture and society is that we now view free speech rights as basically these things that we have to grant to evil people in order to make sure that good people still have their rights. And I get that argument. I think that is a very valid and in some circumstances persuasive argument, but I also don't think it's a sufficient argument. I also think that, like, the fact that we now see it as simply this checks and balances thing, devoid of a moral understanding of what rights and duties are in a democracy, and what is acceptable and what is not in a democracy, in a constitutional republic, is a little depressing to me. I think that, you know, let's put it this way. In 1950, very unlikely that we would let large numbers of Nazis go around marching in front of Jewish homes. I don't think that would make us any less of a decent country, any less democratic, any less of a republic or anything like that. It would be basically making a decision within the confines of recent living memory and our own culture, and said, yeah, we're going to draw a line here. The thing I kept going back at with Sarah, and you should really go back and listen to it if you're at all interested in this stuff. The thing I kept going back to with Sarah was, you know, it feels like a lot of her argument is a slippery slope argument to me. And she says, no, it's not. It's actually the reverse of a slippery slope. I'm not sure that's right. But it's the argument is if we allow this, then we will allow that. And if we allow that, we will allow this other thing. And then so on and so on and so on until we have no freedom at all kind of stuff. And I don't believe that. I think you can draw distinctions. I think cultures can draw bright lines around certain things in good faith without inviting the eventuality of tyranny and autocracy. And so, like, one point I wish I had made when we were talking, it's one I've made before, is that, you know, Germany bans all sorts of Nazi speech. You can argue they go too far with it. I know lots of people do, and maybe they do. I mean, I don't study, you know, limits on Nazi free speech in Germany. It's just I have higher, better uses of my time. But I think reasonable people can believe that Germany's got a pretty good reason. You know, it's sort of like why Germany doesn't give Scientology free rein. Germany has a really bad experience with cults, with small groups of deeply committed people messing things up. And so they restrict more of that stuff. Now, I don't know that very many people think that, like, Germany is currently an authoritarian country or on its way because of this to being some sort of fascistic or communist or otherwise Orwellian state. People are like, I kind of get it. You know, Germans probably need a few, you know, when it comes to Nazis, the Germans should be like belts and suspenders kind of people. Right. And that seems like a perfectly reasonable thing. And this gets at this thing that, you know, I have this constant argument with the sort of NatCon common good conservative people, all that kind of stuff. I'm currently reading Patrick Deneen's, a galley of Patrick Deneen's book where he's heavy into this stuff. This idea that liberalism as a philosophy, as a doctrine on paper, is the place where America draws all of its positions on various public and cultural issues. I think it's just sort of phantasmagorical weird, right? I mean, like, most Americans, I guarantee you, I'm not trying to denigrate, most Americans love this country, right? But if a significant portion of Americans can't tell you what the three branches of government are, I'm pretty sure an even larger number of Americans can't tell you much of interest. They can't give you much information about Locke's Second Treatise on Government, right? Or what Montesquieu's contribution to our constitutional order is, or what the difference is between Madisonian and Hamiltonian democracy, right? I mean, again, I'm not trying to be some pinhead intellectual who casts aspersions on people who don't follow this kind of stuff. In fact, I'm doing the opposite. I'm saying that this stuff is for a rarefied audience. It's an audience I'm proud to be part of. I'm not a particularly prominent member of this audience, but I care about that stuff, right? I care about the sort of intellectual distinctions between all sorts of things. The average American, including the tens of millions of Americans who are either immigrants or the children of immigrants, they, to the extent they're drawing on Lockean liberalism or, you know, Madisonian understandings of this or Hamiltonian understandings of that, or the Federalist Papers or any of that kind of stuff, is by orders of magnitude in remove from any of that. You know, they behave the way they behave because they're Americans. Because America has a culture. America has a distinct culture. Our institutions are formed from the American experience. You know, I mean, like, this is something that political scientists, you know, used to, like, you know, talk about all the times that there were lots of countries that copied our constitution because, hey, look, we were successful in America because of our constitution. So, you know, maybe Paraguay or Argentina, I don't know which countries, but it was a bunch of Latin American countries for starters, basically ripped off our constitution. And they all became, like, you know, non-thriving countries. And a lot of them became sort of banana republic dictatorships and all that kind of stuff. And it's not to say it's because those peoples were bad peoples or any of that kind of stuff. It's just to say that, like, the American success story is only partially about the words on the paper. It's also about the kinds of people that we've got here and the kinds of institutions and traditions and, you know, and the character of the American people. And I mean the character of American people. I mean on the serious left and on the serious right and everything in between. And this idea that somehow our institutions can't work within some of that tradition and draw lines short of where pure reason will take us, I don't agree. And I think that, like, Sarah's position, which also is David's position, you know, they talked about this on the Advisory Opinions podcast. Their position, you know, is very much this is a good result of a virtuous mechanism of government, right? It's sort of like, you know, it's sort of like the Madisonian argument about, you know, checks and balances and divided government, not just vertically, but horizontally across the country. It yields better politics. I agree with that. It's like the mechanistic argument, this argument of sort of the checks and balances argument for free speech, that if I tolerate this group, if we tolerate this group's speech, then we're going to have to tolerate that group's speech, is a solid argument, and particularly in the way the culture is right now, a somewhat persuasive argument for the kind of free speech regime that they want. And that's what I wrote in the Wednesday G-File. But, you know, it's sort of like there are you know, one of the arguments for why are Jews so liberal is that there is, among some people, this idea coming out of the civil rights movement that Jews need to protect, need to be good allies for other minorities to protect their own freedom, right? And I think it's an entirely valid point of view. I think it is a perfectly good argument for cultural and, you know, politics and all that. But it's sort of analogous to Sarah's argument about the free speech list. I just don't think it's sufficient, because when you start sort of defining the American political system like it's a game of Monopoly, right? And look, in a game of Monopoly, you all start out with the same amount of money, the same resources. The only difference is one guy's a hat, one guy's a dog, one guy's a thimble or whatever. There is, and so you can just refer to the pieces as pieces, because in the instructions, because it doesn't matter which piece you have, the same rules apply to everybody, right? That's the way, if you go back and you read stuff about Skokie and stuff, it's like the way that people talk about the Nazis, they talk about them like they're a minority. And I think that the problem with that kind of language is that it obscures more than it reveals. Yes, Nazis are a minority in this country, thank God. I would be pretty offended if someone said, you know, all minorities have rights, blacks, gays, Jews, Nazis, rapists, blah, 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 blah. Even though it is true that Nazis and rapists have rights, because we all have rights, right? We all have rights to face our accuser. We all have rights to a fair trial. We all have rights to free speech to one extent or another, right? Blah, 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 blah. But not all minorities are equal. Not all minority ambitions are equal. And being a Nazi is not like being a member of a group that confers a certain identity from birth. You have to choose to one extent or another to be a Nazi or to be a Klansman. And when we reduce these arguments down to these justifications for things like free speech and minority rights to just simply saying, as long as you are a minority, all claims of all minorities are equally valid. And I just don't think that's true. I certainly don't think that's true culturally or morally. And I'm less comfortable, even though I think it's the reality, I'm less comfortable with the idea that it's true legally. If the United States had Germany's policy of curtailing Nazi speech, I'm not sure that it would be the right policy. I'm not sure it would lead to the right results. That's a perfectly open debate to have. I don't think it would make America a meaningfully worse country or less worthy country of our respect and love. It's a judgment call. And that's what I mean about Sarah's sort of, and not just Sarah, because she's speaking for like the majority of the commenters, the majority of people who make these arguments on this kind of stuff, by reducing things to sort of a mechanistic kind of, whether you're the hat, the thimble, or the dog on the board, you all have the same rights kind of argument. It loses some of the cultural importance of and the institutional memory of what the Constitution is actually for. And I don't think the Constitution was actually formed as a means to protect Nazis to march in front of old Holocaust survivors' houses. Anyway, you probably, if you're interested in this, you know where I'm coming from. If you're not interested in this, you probably heard too much already. Okay, I gotta go. But lastly, on the Harlan Crow thing, I did not appreciate how much worse it could possibly get when I recorded my limited defense of Harlan. For those of you who don't know, I'm friends with Harlan Crow. I'm proud to be Harlan Crow's friend. Harlan Crow is one of the most considerate, decent, nicest people I've ever met. Did he make some mistakes in how he, you know, behaved with vis-a-vis Clarence Thomas? Totally reasonable arguments to be had there. I put more of the blame on Clarence Thomas. There was just this revelation late yesterday that Thomas didn't declare that Harlan had bought Clarence Thomas's mother's home to turn into some sort of like landmark thing. And he should have disclosed that. I think he should have disclosed that. I think Clarence Thomas should have disclosed that. I think I don't know the backstory. I mean, I truly and sincerely believe Harlan is telling the truth when he says he wanted to be like a landmark thing to preserve it for history. He buys all sorts of stuff to preserve for history. He believes passionately in preserving history. He's a crazy history buff. And when things calm down, I'll talk more about that. I'd love to have Harlan on the podcast to talk to him about this stuff. Totally fair criticisms to be made, or at least totally colorable criticisms to be made, certainly of Clarence Thomas, definitely of Jenny Thomas, definitely of like how all of this, you know, appears from a distance and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not here to be Harlan Crowe's lawyer or Clarence Thomas's lawyer. But over the weekend, it was astounding to me how the mob went nuts. And all this stuff I say about how dangerous and terrible Tucker and Marjorie Taylor Greene and these people on the right are for distorting reality and getting worked up into feeding frenzies. I got to tell you, I'm really kind of bummed out. I'm kind of better about it now, but I was really bummed out about how what I saw last week was psychologically just as bad. Like, I've been to the Garden of Evil. It's this thing where Harlan collected a bunch of statues of dictators and other horrible people, mostly communists of the 20th century. And it was always intended to be sort of a never forget kind of thing. Harlan's a good anti-communist. He's also just sort of fascinated with Russian history. And he's talked about it in interviews. It's not like some sort of secret, but as what often happens when people who don't know anything suddenly learn one thing, they seem to think that they're experts on everything about it. And, you know, it's sort of like, I remember Jane Mayer writing this idiotic piece for the New Yorker about how the Koch brothers were deeply involved in libertarian and right-wing politics and how sinister it was. What made it sinister was that it was news to her. But if you'd actually followed right-wing and particularly libertarian politics, which is a pretty small universe of politics, you'd know that, you know, one of the Koch brothers had run for vice president of the United States on the libertarian ticket, that they founded the Cato Institute. I mean, like, it was not a revelation to anybody but the people who didn't know anything. And similarly with the Harlan Crowe stuff, like 5 minutes of Googling, you could find out what his actual explanation was for the Garden of Evil. But instead, I spent the weekend, because I defended the Garden of Evil thing, because, like, you know, there was this Patriot Takes Twitter account, which I used to follow. I dropped so many people in the last 7 days. I'm just so disgusted with them. You know, I defended the Garden of Evil, saying, look, it's basically a never again kind of concept. It's trying to remember the evils of the 20th century. And I had people, supposedly smart people, people who seem like smart, decent people from their bios or their previous tweets or people who I followed, treating me like I was some sort of friggin' idiot for not understanding that this guy I've known for a decade is evil and he celebrates evil. And that's why he created the Garden of Evil. And it's like, you know, not since I remember watching Captain Planet cartoons in high school, where like the villains were always, of course, polluters were like, if we can only bury all of this toxic radioactive waste under America's playgrounds, we will be triumphant, right? I mean, it's like, it was that level of stupid to think that this guy was actually objectively celebrating evil, owning evil as his value, and built a garden and some sort of like tribute to Baal or something, or Beelzebub as a sort of his offering unto evil. Similarly, the idea that he was a Nazi, I mean, Like, again, he's not a Nazi. Go read Graham Wood's piece in The Atlantic. It is a grotesque smear to call him a Nazi, you know, by this sort of, you know, he collects stuff. The stuff that he collects about Nazis is maybe, from my experience, I don't know, I don't keep track of his entire inventory, but from my experience, it's probably 0.0000001% of the things he collects. Like, the things he gives pride of placement to aren't some Nazi Lenins or something. It's like Eisenhower's D-Day helmet or Abraham Lincoln's desk from the state legislature. He's just wildly into Americana stuff, particularly like civic Americana stuff. And he's just a profoundly decent guy. And to see people, a lot of like very prominent, serious people, just because, I'm utterly convinced of this, is that on a mass psychology scale, what happened was it dawned on a bunch of people that the ProPublica piece was not going to destroy Clarence Thomas. And so they fall back, sort of psychological consolation prize and political plan B was to say, okay, Clarence Thomas is illegitimate because he's because he's friends with a Nazi, and or as a bunch of people called it, Nazi sympathizer. Harlan Crowe is the farthest thing from a Nazi sympathizer. It's a grotesque slander. And I know that there are a lot of people who think I'm bought and paid for or compromised or whatever, or I'm biased. Yeah, I'm biased in the fact that I actually know the guy and I think incredibly highly of him. And I know that he's a decent guy who just is being just cruelly slandered. And the fact that he's rich, you know, doesn't change that fact at all. And so anyway, like, the thing that really kind of bummed me out was, you know, I've tried really, really hard. If you see me on CNN, I do not go, you know, full Jen Rubin. I am not letting go of the conservative positions that I hold dear, that I truly believe are true. And that's why I support them. And I paid a price for this over the last 7 years. Lost friends. I subjected to daily mockery and harassment from people, you know, for punching right and violating the popular front stuff and all that kind of stuff. And but I've also tried really hard not to let like the strange new respect of the left seduce me into like abandoning positions that I think are correct objectively. Right. I haven't like done a Max Boot thing where I say, well, everything I believe and said about conservatism over the last 20 years was wrong. And now I'm a liberal. Right. I haven't done any of that stuff. And I get a lot of flattery from people that makes it uncomfortable to actually have to say, you know, you guys are wrong about all of these things, you know, on TV, in print, you know, in conversations. But I also kind of thought that like, I got some benefit of the doubt, right? The idea that somehow I was giving in to, that somehow I've conducted myself with some modicum of integrity over the last 7 years. And then to hear people tell me that it is obvious I'm lying because this guy they hadn't heard of 48 hours earlier is clearly a Nazi and clearly bribing Clarence Thomas. There's no evidence that he's bribing Clarence Thomas. I think the idea that was Harlan Crowe's motivation is spurious and ridiculous. But regardless, the idea that like, yeah, I'm rising to the defense of a Nazi because I'm bought and paid for, or I'm an idiot after spending 7 years refusing to drink the Kool-Aid on all things Trump and, you know, inviting, outrage and scorn from the neo-Nazi alt-right punks and all these guys on a regular basis. The idea that it was all a con, according to these people, it really pissed me off. And it just turned me off on politics in a huge way. I haven't felt that remnant-y in years. Because I had utter contempt for so many people who either weren't rising to the defense of this guy. And I don't mean rising to the defense because they have to rise because he's more important than all sorts of other people who get slandered, but like just standing in the way of the stupidity of some of this stuff. and not joining in and retweeting and one-upping one asinine bit after another. And all these people who just came right at me and, you know, told me I was a fool, that I was clearly lying, that I'm bought and paid for, that I'm compromised, that clearly I'm just doing this for partisan reasons and all these kinds of things. And it's like, what's the friggin' point? You know? So it was pretty dispiriting. And, I'm kind of over it now for the most part. I'm still, you know, very concerned for my friend. And, and I got to say, you know, after 7 years of losing friends, you know, like people, you know, I don't expect everybody to like remember every jot and detail of what the last 7 years was like was for me. But like, you know, I didn't enjoy criticizing, you know, people like Chris DeMuth and Bill Bennett and, you know, Roger Kimball. I mean, you can go down a list of like right wing conservative intellectuals and institutions. I mean, I'm at my peace with criticizing the Claremont Institute these days, even though I still think there are decent people there. I think the public facing part of it is hot garbage these days, or at least it's, you know, I mean, the magazine is, the journal is still fine. Mostly it prints some people that I think should have no business in public life sometimes. But, you know, I take no joy in these kinds of things. I lament them. And so the idea that like somehow all that counts for nothing, and I'm just a hack who, you know, is defending this guy for illegitimate reasons, it pisses me off. You know, I wish I could still be, you know, friends with Bill Bennett the way I was. Lots of people I wish I could still be friends with the way I was. But anyway, enough about me. Just, I wanted to be clear because I was getting a lot of weird email from people. Some people were saying, good for you, sticking up for your friend, blah, 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 blah. Other people were like changing the subject to, you know, criticism of Clarence Thomas, which again, you're free to do. I think Clarence Thomas definitely should have disclosed this stuff about the house. I do think that he was under no particular obligation to disclose, according to the ethics rules, the previous stuff that was reported. I don't think Clarence Thomas, there's any sign that Clarence Thomas is corrupt in terms of his rulings. And if you ever met Clarence Thomas, he's a very sweet, charming, you know, guy. And I feel sorry for him. But on the other hand, you know, I think the way his wife has behaved in the last 5 years, at least 2 years, has been abhorrent. So I'm happy to make these distinctions. But that's all I've been saying for the last 7 years is all I can do is try to tell truth as I see it. And I got no problem with people saying I'm wrong. I get really pissed off when people with confidence tell me that they are more expert on my motives than I am. And that, you know, when they talk to me like they know why I'm really doing something and have to educate me on it. Like, I need education on lots of things. I don't need education on my motives. And anyway, I don't mean to get all testy and sanctimonious, but now I have to go do media training. So I'm looking forward to seeing as many as you can at the Remnant event on May 1st. Apologies for the hitting the maximum occupancy thing, but we are going to do more of these things. If people want to sponsor a Remnant meetup, a Dispatch meetup, that kind of thing, we really want to ramp up this year. And I'm not going to lie, as a business proposition, right? We want to do it. We want to be growing more robustly. We want to get more members. We want to sell more swag. We want to give people more value for their subscription by having this sort of sense of community and fellowship. We launched the Dispatch for a whole lot of reasons, but one was to have a successful business, and the demand to attend these things is really, really strong, which we find it's a huge boost to our morale. And it's a lot of fun. So we want to do more of them. So if there are people out there who want to sponsor one, or have ideas about who could sponsor one, you know, drop us a line. For now, you can send it to Jonah@thedispatch.com. Also probably send it to Ryan@thedispatch.com, even though Ryan is on paternity leave, and congratulations. Very, very, very cute baby. And other big announcements to come. So with that, thanks for listening, and I will talk to you later.
Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.